Hello and welcome to your weekly dose of the latest sustainability fun news, facts and reviews brought to you by the Green Elephant. This week, people win a landmark ruling against the government in France. Company climate disclosures to become mandatory. We speak to Zero Carbon 2030 about their new ratings app. And possibly the most moving animation you'll see all year. Joining me to discuss these and more, as usual, is Russell. Morning, Russell.
Good morning, Mike. It's a bit cold in my cellar. I was nice and smug during the winter, during the summer months, whilst you were all boiling to death in your offices, and I was nice and cool in the cellar. Now I'm absolutely freezing.
And anyway, listeners, I think I will do a screen cap of Russell in his hat, because, yeah. Also coming up, our education challenge, all the news, and of course, the return of Fact or Fake. So, many countries have lessons to learn from a landmark ruling that found France at fault for failing to take enough action to tackle the climate crisis. Mm. And this made a lot of news outlets this week. I heard it on the radio here in the UK. But the court found that the French state failed to take sufficient action to fight climate change. And this was in a case brought by Oxfam in France, Greenpeace France, and two other organisations. The Paris Administrative Court, in its ruling, recognised ecological damage linked to climate change and held the French state responsible for failing to fully meet its goals in reducing greenhouse gases. Now, I guess this is interesting in that the court found that the French state didn't fully meet its goals in reducing greenhouse gases. Now, we talked about government targets a few weeks back, and how many governments did we say have met their targets for climate change?
I didn't think we found any, did we?
No, exactly. No. So, So
what
on the face
fact
of it,
or fake then?
No, that's not. We're not there yet. Not quite. A few minutes to go. Yeah, but it does raise the question: if all governments fail to meet their climate targets, as we've discussed before, then potentially they're all at risk from, you know, suffering the same legal action and result that the French state has met, and, you know, given laws of precedence and stuff, you know, there's a good chance of that. And I guess the other thing is that I noticed from this story is the case was brought by Oxfam in France, Greenpeace France, and two other organisations. Do we think that Oxfam and Greenpeace will let it rest at one country and one victory?
I somehow feel not. And it's interesting they've taken it to court, because it was, because we said before, the problem with the Paris Agreement, it is nothing more than an agreement. It doesn't in itself legally bind a government to achieve its targets. But certain governments have taken on that legislative goal as such, and they've set themselves goals. And those that have are now going to be, you know, a target quite justifiably. As you said, you're going to do this. You set it in legislation. Now you haven't. So how are you going to, you know, compensate?
Yeah. So this was all about, you know, in terms of the targets that were discussed, it were national targets that had been set under the 2015 Paris Agreement. I guess it doesn't help that it's in the country that this happened, of your capital city. But anyway, under the Paris Agreement to curb the climate change. And it's delayed these efforts. Interestingly, in the UK this week, the UK's Climate Change Committee said the government's current policies mean the country is likely to fall short of achieving our targets. I think look out for a court case in a city in a country near you. The story specifically that we're referencing refers to Scotland. Yeah. Because they have various targets. There's a Scottish parliamentary election coming up, and Oxfam Scotland is using this as a stick to beat up, you know, politicians ahead of the new elections, saying you are going to ensure these targets are met, aren't you? And Scotland's got quite an ambitious target. It says here they're going to cut their emissions by 75% by 2030.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, great if they can. One thing I was looking at, I mean, and to cut it by 75%, you know, because
isn't there a problem with that?
Well, think they're about already what, actually in emission terms, in electricity generation, they're actually not bad. So actually, to cut it further is quite.
But
hard.
What is one of the major industries from Aberdeen in Scotland? North Sewell, isn't it?
Oh yes, absolutely.
the major part of the Scottish economy.
Their import, they could export most of that emission creation because they're not the ones burning it.
Or just move the problem elsewhere. Yay!
Back to Norway last month, who managed to not invest in coal and oil anymore in their funds, but they're still producing tons of it.
Like. I wonder if it's going to be like other offshoring, where countries are going to move their emissions targets elsewhere, and we'll have every country in Europe has met their targets, but Malta has missed it by 8,000,000%.
Because we just all shoved it over there,
Oh dear.
Well, we'll watch that one. Good old, come on, Scotland. It's funny how that Scotland sticks out. Scotland's going to come up for, if they do try and go for independence from the UK as well, they're going to have even bigger. They're going to have as a country instead of part in Europe. It'd be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, but I think it big story, that one, because we will see other countries taken to court for missing their climate targets, and if that's the precedent that's followed, then we'll see lots of other victories for the people and for the organisations against their government. So
I'm intrigued. Who goes to prison? I mean, what's the impact? What are they going to do? Slap on the wrist? Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, we missed them, and that's the problem with these targets. There's nothing. Macron's not off to jail. He doesn't have to personally pay us all a couple of quid. And I don't know. Anyway,
but I guess it's the court of public opinion, isn't it? You know, you've missed our targets. You politicians have failed. Therefore, we will vote somebody else in because you're failing.
But will they?
And politician
wants
that. It's
going to be really interesting to watch how this all pans out.
At monthly challenge time now, and as it's February, we are doing our education challenge, and that's some really good feedback to the definitions that we put out last week. Saying they were helpful, so that's really, really good to hear. So we're following up again this week with four more terms. So kicking off with a greenhouse effect. Now, you may have seen a glass or plastic building used by a gardener to create a warmer place to grow plants. However, the conditions in a gardener's greenhouse is nothing new. The greenhouse effect is natural and essential process, which has been around ever since the Earth had an atmosphere. We mentioned global warming last week, same thing really, but to further explain, when the sun's energy reaches the Earth, some of that gets reflected back, and the rest get absorbed into the land and the oceans, warming the planet to roughly 33 degrees Celsius. That stored heat is then radiated back towards space, where some is stopped by certain gases. And this greenhouse effect keeps the Earth at a temperature which can support life. The gases in the atmosphere which prevent the heat escaping are finely balanced. And the problem with the greenhouse effect is not the greenhouse effect.
No.
It's when those gases are out of balance with the natural order. So the greenhouse effect is fine until it becomes out of balance and it gets too warm. But anyway, on gases.
Yeah, well, by far the most, and this is what a lot of people don't think of, by far the most important gas in the atmosphere, which keeps the Earth warm, is water vapor. Because we hear so much about CO2.
Back to school science lessons, isn't it? Is water vapor a solid, or is it a gas?
Gas. Anyway. Yes, but water is one of those fantastic things that can exist in all those states. Then the next most prevalent that we hear a lot about is carbon dioxide. Then we've got things like methane or cow farts, as it's otherwise known as. I think that's the chemical name. Nitrous oxide and ozone, which all occur naturally. there are other things, synthetic ones, that we've managed to create as well, which are fluorinated gases like chlorofluorocarbons, which were very popular in fridges back in the day. Yes. And they're all man-made, but they have their own damage. So although the water vapor is responsible for around about 60% of the greenhouse effect, as you said, the impact of these less prominent gases is the fact that they alter this fine balance. So I think of the greenhouse that you mentioned, is sometimes when it gets too hot in the greenhouse, they open a vent.
Yeah, you open the vent.
We can't do that because we'd lose we'd lose the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It would be a bad thing to do. So the changes in this balance of these gases can increase or could decrease the greenhouse effect. So to avoid us having to understand the impact of each of those gases, because they all have a different impact on the water vapor, we can use a single measure, which we're going to go into now, Mike.
Yeah. CO2e, and I love this. I love the for a long time I wondered what the E was. I thought CO2. I know what that is. I did that in school science. I know that's carbon dioxide. That's chemically known as CO2, and you know that's long been the discussion of greenhouse gases. We know it's the thing that we all produce. We discussed that last week, and we emit it when we breathe and when we burn fossil fuels and things like that. However, gram for gram, CO2 has the least impact of the gases we mentioned earlier. Methane, CH4, a few science buffs, has 25 times more potential impact on global warming. Nitrous oxide, N2O, is 298 times worse. However, some of the synthetic gases like sulfur hexafluoride can be equivalent to over 22,000 times the same amount of CO2. So CO2 is not all bad news there. So in order to avoid having to keep the impact of the vast array of gases that there are in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide equivalent or CO2e measure was born. So E for equivalent. Scientists now more commonly use CO2e to represent the impact of a gas in relation to something we're more aware of, which is carbon dioxide. So that's it on greenhouse gases and CO2 and greenhouse effects. Now for something completely different.
Yes, this is something that we, when we started on our sustainability journeys, you heard about SDGs, and for a while you kept quiet in meetings and conferences to see
what's that
SDGs are. So if you've heard this phrase, it's a snappy abbreviation which stands for the sustainable development goals, which the UN set back in 2016, and it's their aim, these goals is for 2030. And just going to run through, there are 17, they're also known as global goals, but a lot of people just refer to them as SDGs. And there are 17. I'm only going to list them out this time because each one of these could have a show of its own.
You're going to do your Fluff Alan Freeman pick of the pots countdown?
In
at one!
I don't know if I can. Okay. But
anyway,
we've got number one is no poverty, as you mentioned. We've got zero hunger. I mean, these are all for 2030. So imagine this worldwide. It's not just in our country. Good health and well-being. Quality education is number four, and gender equality is number five. In at six, I'm doing it. Clean water and sanitation. Number seven, affordable and clean energy. And then at eight, decent work and economic growth. At nine, we see industry, innovation and infrastructure, which doesn't sound like a goal much, just sounds like a heading. Number 10, in reducing equality. 11 is sustainable cities and communities, with 12 being responsible consumption and production, which we're very up for. Number 13 is climate action, with 14 of life below water and 15 being life on land. And then the final two are 16, we're considering, obviously, this is for all, peace, justice and strong institutions, and then forming partnerships for the goals, which we've got a little bit on in a bit with regards to the B Corps. So, as I said, not going to go through these, but each of these would warrant a massive amount of discussion on their own. So instead, I'm going to point you, we'll point you to something in the show pages on the SDG UN site.
Yeah, yeah. And just also point people, I think it was episode 6 where we interviewed the author of the UN SDG report. We had the lead of that report on the show talking about all things SDG. So if you're interested, listen to that. And
just, we can link just, back to that one on the show notes.
Yeah,
as well.
Just to give some context, the idea is that people, organisations, you know, doing all 17 is tricky. But you pick one or two out of the list and you say, we're going to focus on industry, innovation, and infrastructure, or we're going to focus on climate action. And so you can target your efforts. Right. An international accounting body said on Tuesday it would set out a definitive proposal in September for global rules to govern company disclosures and risks from climate change. This came from the International Accounting Standards Board, so it is a body with some weight, and these rules are used in about 150 countries. So that is 3/4 of the countries in the world use these rules, including Britain and the EU, but not yet in the US. And this is on the back of investors calling for globally comparable disclosures to stop greenwashing, and we talked about how to spot greenwashing a couple of shows ago, whereby firms talk a good game on responding to climate change, but fail to follow through with concrete actions. So what they're looking to do is to leading to an announcement on creating global sustainability standards during the UN COP26 in November. So International Accounting Standards Board looking to make an announcement on mandatory climate disclosures for companies by November. So this is a really big shift.
That's a big shift, yeah.
What we're saying is that 150 countries, your accounting standards are going to require you to have the same climate disclosures across companies, across countries.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be a major shift in the way that we evaluate companies, as part of our interview later in the show, actually, about evaluating company performance. But
yeah,
you know, an international standard measure of climate impact.
I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I mean, it's and it's what's needed. As we've always said, you can't manage anything you can't measure. And until we have these standards, we found on so many occasions, like the CO2e thing, until you can get to that easy to understand measure that you can see whether something's performing or not, you can't manage it.
Yeah, and this this board they've said first they're going to test the appetite and potential funding for this project, and they've already had a public consultation, and it said the responses indicate growing and urgent demand to improve the global consistency and comparability and sustainability reporting. And I think, you know, that response is really interesting. Growing and urgent demand is not something you see from a survey response very often at all. And, you know, this is going to replace the current voluntary and patchy kind of standards that are currently in place. So,
and I don't know, you've got your head very much more in the news, Mike, but the COP26 event that's happening in November, we kind of at the beginning in the beginning of the year, we kind of thought at the end of the year that's kind of a bit too late to make a big difference in 2021. But what it has created is kind of a
sparking action,
and there seems to be so much coming out which is pushing towards this COP conference, which I think if you haven't looked up COP26. You need to now.
We might have to take a road trip to Glasgow in them. Although we're quite lucky in that they're all coming to Cornwall, the G20 or whatever. They're coming round off next to our friend's house in the summer. So we'll be able to have a cup of tea on his balcony and watch that one as it's happening. But maybe a trip to Glasgow as well.
Watch him go by.
Right, let's take a look at some other big sustainability news stories from the week. Now, Russell, Canoe is a company name, CANOO. What do you think Canoe make?
I'm guessing cars.
It'd be nice if they were canoes, but it's not. It's electric vehicles, and this company, it's a startup called Canoe, has unveiled a 100% electric delivery van. Now, that's not particularly revolutionary at this stage. However, the price, of $33,000 is astounding. That is remarkably cheap for something that's bigger than a kind of a Ford Transit van to do your deliveries in. That is just amazing. 230 miles per charge. So congratulations to Canoe for achieving that.
And what a funky looking thing it is. I don't know if I love it or loathe it, but it's,
yeah, it is.
It's functional. It doesn't seem to obey some of the rounded rules. It's a box delivering boxes, I'm guessing. That's good. IKEA is starting to buy up the US, presumably because they don't trust them to look after it themselves. I'm assuming this is southeastern Georgia, where the Inca group has acquired over 10,000 acres of land in southwest good Georgia to protect it from developments. And it's at the hands of IKEA, who have bought up, this company, this Inca group, has bought up over 600,000 acres of forested land in the US, Latvia, Estonia, Romania, Lithuania. So, an interesting approach, and there was a horrific statistic with regards to the US that before the arrival of Europeans in the US, the forest covered about 90 million acres. However, due to land clearing for development and fire suppression and agriculture, only 4% remains.
Scary.
We look at the Amazon, I think of deforestation. No, Europeans already did it.
And I guess it's fundamental to IKEA's business, you know. Without any forests, how they're going to make their furniture? So they need to come up with some sustainable
Nugan
options. Really interesting use of blockchain technology now from Rio Tinto. So Rio Tinto, huge mining company, and that, you know, has its issues to discuss another time. But an initiative they've announced this week, which is a good thing, is to use a new labeling method on aluminium, which we know can be endlessly recycled, based on blockchain technology. So that can't be changed. It can't be altered in any way. So for a piece of aluminium, you customers in future will receive this digital sustainability label, and they'll be able to see the provenance and the history of the aluminium that they're getting, all protected within the blockchain. So that seems to me to be a good initiative. I mean, technically,
kind of bonkers. I mean, one of the problems we talked about before is supply chain. It's very difficult to work out where your stuff has come from, and if your supplier says it's it's all recycled aluminium, and you get really interesting. Looking at some big oil giants in the form of BP and Total, who are spending billions on
saving their businesses,
something like that. wind. They've taken up the largest share of options to build offshore wind farms awarded by the UK government that was this week.
Like I said, saving their businesses. Once the oil's gone and nobody wants fossil fuels anymore,
nobody wants to burn
it. They need a business.
They need to own the things that's generating electricity. And it makes complete sense that they do this. I agree that. So they've shed out £879 million or about $1.2 billion on securing these. Then, of course, they've got to build them. And bring them to fruition. So it's a massive investment for them to deliver that.
Yeah.
These offshore wind farms can produce a lot of energy. And of course, we in Britain are very famous for our wind.
Yeah, absolutely. Seattle City Council now, moving on to sort of more government focused news, have passed a new energy code that means they've banned gas for space and water heating in new buildings.
Yes.
And this is a great start. Now they've limited it to commercial and apartment buildings taller than three stories. So if you are, you know, building a single dwelling for yourself, you could still use gas. But those people with the deep pockets who can afford to put the renewables in and do the right thing are now going to be compelled to do so in Seattle. And I think that's a good first step. And hopefully more cities will follow suit.
Yep. And it's obviously all of these add to the fact that countries need to, as we said earlier, ramp up their efforts towards climate pledges, because it says 80%.
Of cities are not meeting, was it countries? 80% of countries are not meeting their pledges.
Yeah, sorry, suddenly you had a jump on my screen. The pledges countries made to reduce emissions as part of the 2015 Paris Agreement, going back to that, are woefully inadequate. So the problem is that they'll hit them because they're pathetic. It's just not challenging enough.
So it's a double whammy, isn't it? Back to our top story.
Yep.
The targets are woefully inadequate, and they'll still miss those inadequate targets. Yeah. So it's worse than rubbish. And we're just
not going to, any of the goals that we might have for 2050 are in the bin, because now, of course, you miss one target, you have to double your efforts. You have to make more extreme change instead of perhaps the slow slope.
Yeah.
But it needs to ramp up quite dramatically.
Yeah, it's a bit rubbish, as is the reporting of carbon footprints by cities, because a study this week found that American cities are underreporting their emissions by almost 20%. And if you apply this to all cities in the US, the potentially unreported carbon would equal 129 billion metric tons, or 25% more than all of California's emissions in 2015. Oh. So this underreporting, and I guess it's obvious why they're underreporting, because when they've got a target to reduce, it's easier to reduce targets and give out silly figures. So disappointing, I think, is the thing there. However, what's not disappointing is liberté, égalité, and repairability. I'm not quite sure that's the actual phrase.
You should be in Les Mis.
I should indeed.
That was so impressive. Well, you were.
Well, yeah. France's new repairability index is a big deal. So France is, from last month, now requiring makers of electronic devices, including smartphones and laptops, to tell the customers how repairable their products are. So if no longer is there the Apple, you can't repair this or do anything with it because you're not Apple authorized, but the companies will have to tell you. And they're going to be given a score on the repairability index. So when you buy one of these new devices, you're going to see where does it come on the repairability index, and therefore how does it fit into the circular economy, and is it repairable, and can I change my lithium battery or whatever? So I mean,
it's good. We've got some interviews coming up in March on which we'll cover on circular economy, so that'll be interesting, good as well. Moving now to a bit of technology news, we've got Tasmania, a place close to my heart, and I suppose I can take the advantage of my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law and his wife had their little baby boy, Avery, today.
Okay.
And they live in Tasmania. So Tasmania. I thought I'd jump in here on the Tasmanian story and give him a shout out. But Tasmania, if you look at Tasmania, it does look like it's got a couple of island horns on it. It's why it's called.
Oh, yes.
Demon's Land, or Van Diemen's Land as it was in its old time. And the left-hand one of those is called King Island. And that island has about 1,700 people on it, and they are going to employ wave power. So having already been covered solar and wind and getting a fair bit of their electricity, they're going to top it off with wave power. And of course, they've got a lot of waves around there. And so, yeah, I mean, it's great that one of the first places in the world to be drawing from three sustainable resources. So shout out good old Tasmania. They're surprising. Half the place is a national park. Half the island is a national park. It's absolutely massive. If you ever get to go there, I'd recommend it. But yeah it's great to see them doing this as well.
So all the talk at the moment is of renewables and wind and solar and things. But we kind of have forgotten in that talk of new technology and wave and things that actually we've been doing renewable as a globe for decades, you know, since the 40s and the 50s, and probably even earlier, but certainly from them on, then on a large scale, hydropower using dams. And certainly in the US and the UK and lots of other countries, a significant amount of energy is produced by using those. And it's been a little bit forgotten in the race to new renewables and things like that. So the International Energy Agency has said we need to give more attention to hydropower, and it can be really useful in, you know, meeting CO2 emissions targets. So just some awareness and a shout out for hydropower, really.
Yay. I mean, it's quite funny, really, because you go to Las Vegas, which is the probably the least sustainable city in the world, I would say, with the amount of lights they got.
Yep.
And the whole thing is done from hydropower. Of course, they've
in the desert. There's a question. Which is the least sustainable city in the world? Is it Las Vegas? Or is it Dubai? Or is it, what is the least sustainable city?
There's got to be a stat on that somewhere. The amount of CO2 the city has. We'll have to hunt that.
We'll have to look that one out. Anyway.
Now, one of the problems that the pandemic has brought us is the famous phrase PPE, which used to be the you used to have that in business and only your health and safety people would know what PPE is. And now the world knows what PPE is. And our most popular part of personal protective equipment is the face mask. But of course, you, like I, have seen them lying all over the floor and the beach and all sorts of places, a tremendous amount of waste generated. Well, somebody has started to make roads with them.
No. Well, somebody was making mattresses with them, weren't they, a few weeks ago?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were twisting up the into
nice mattresses. Roads you can sleep on.
But now, this would be an uncomfortable sleep. But what they have found is that this processed building rubble, which is normally used as the three base layers for roads, can now have these face shredded face masks added to it. And it enhances the material further. Yeah. So Australia again, shout out. We can't help but avoid that Australia are certainly striving ahead with sustainability.
Yeah. In some respects, yeah.
Starting these roads.
Spinach now, and it's not a story about Popeye. It's a story about using spinach becoming biological sensors, which will email environmental alerts to you. And this is amazing technology. They're putting nanobiotic sensors into plants that can then detect changes in groundwater and chemicals and stuff that are then coming up through the spinach. And then depending on those nanoparticles that come up into the plants, an email can then be sent to a farmer to say, oh, your crops aren't going to grow very well this year, or there's this bad insect landed on your plant and is chomping on it, or any number of different messages. So it's interesting kind of technology, but I guess that's great. Would you want to eat a piece of spinach with this implanted in it? Which is
when did it stop sending emails?
Well, who knows?
You've been successfully pooped out.
That's a mailing list to unsubscribe from, isn't it?
I've seen enough. strange story here. I don't know if this is an auction you're interested in, Mike, but Namibia has put 170 elephants up for auction.
I won't be bidding.
I don't think so. Bizarrely enough, they've said that the number of elephants in the country has grown from 7,500 in 95 to 24,000 today. Brilliant news, because we knew that elephants were always under a poaching risk and all sorts of things. The trouble is, there's now a human wildlife conflict in the country, which I like that as a term. Where humans normally win, and they are here, due to the strain on the available resources. So conservationists are starting to say, hold on, this isn't right. And there's arguments about borders and that the elephants migrate between other countries, and therefore Namibia can't take responsibility for all of these, and therefore shouldn't be in a position to, thin them down. So a bit of an argument going on there between Namibia and Botswana and other places where elephants we hope would run free and wild and not be auctioned off to the highest bidder.
Well, auction the people and get the people to move.
yes. And just, it's a fairly big country, but
Anyway, the naval orange worm. Sounds particularly painful, doesn't it?
Belly button or something, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. It costs California state nuts growers millions of dollars each year. And warmer growing season will give the insects time to do even more damage. And I'm kind of not quite sure how to feel about this one. So they're saying there's a climate story. This the naval orange worm is becoming more prevalent and doing more damage. But it's doing damage to almonds, walnuts, pistachios, those crops that require vast amounts of water to grow. And I'm kind of, you know, it's an example of a story where, you know, it's put there as a climate environment story. This is a bad thing. These worms are growing and these naval orange worms are going to cost the growers millions of dollars in losses each year, set against the damage of growing these crops in the first place. And, you know, why do humans need to eat these vast amounts of nuts? So it's a really interesting story.
It's a contradictory
story.
It's really one of these, our growth in desire to eat nuts and pistachios, you know, has to be said that a lot of that kind of stuff is ate by people on specific diets.
Yep.
And therefore, you know, growers react to the demand and do drastic things to produce it.
As somebody on a plant-based vegan diet, you probably are eating lots of nuts, but are you aware of the amount of water that is being...
And there used to be that nuts were kind of a treat at Christmas in the UK.
It did, yeah.
Now it's you can get any type of nut any time of year. It doesn't really matter.
Anyway.
Carrying on with these pests, we've got another story about invasive insects and diseases are killing our forests. So in this bizarre world where we think that we're offsetting by planting forests, we've got a whole stack of insects and diseases which are striking our forest quite dramatically. You know, we've seen things like we saw Dutch elm disease, didn't we? Wipe out a stack of trees in the UK many years ago. And these plagues are continuing and it appears to be getting worse. There's the hemlock infestation and...
There's the emerald ash borer beetle and the spotted lantern fly and things that have been imported from, you know, other
I suppose it's that it crosses a border. It crosses into a country that has where its normal predators are not there, and it thrives and in the process it destroys our forests. So we've got a real issue with the fact that we're trying to spread our globalization is causing localized disasters.
An answer now to the question of why are electric vehicles better than gas or petrol powered cars? And the answer is simpler than you might think. A study has found that electric vehicle owners drive them less. They drive half as many miles annually as the average gas or petrol power car. So they're better for the environment because they just
not exactly the intention of it.
I'm sure it's not the intention, but that is the result according to this survey. I think University of California looked at the respective mileages. So there we go. Green Earth Show bringing you the truth behind the facts there. So today I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast Shana Burke from Zero Carbon 2030. Hello, Shana. I was about to say good morning, but it's not, is it?
No, it's evening here, Mike, but thank you for the introduction.
You're welcome. And Shana is in Brisbane, Australia. And my first question, Shana, is you're a carbon analyst for Zero Carbon 2030. Now, what's a carbon analyst and how does somebody go about becoming a carbon analyst? It's not the usual job title.
No, it's certainly not. And I think there's probably not really one way to answer that, but I'll give it a go. Zero, as a carbon analyst, it's not analyzing carbon as in as you can see it in the atmosphere, because as you we know, you can't actually see it.
You don't get to look at lots of diamonds then?
No, I'm okay. Not staring at a telescope or anything like that. So Zero Carbon 2030 is a not-for-profit environment organization aimed at empowering consumers to be able to add to the momentum of the urgent climate action we need. Our ethos is that governments are traditionally not leaders. They are traditionally followers. So we have been quite underwhelmed with their actions in the climate change space. So our fundamental belief is that businesses can lead, but unfortunately businesses are motivated by profit. So how can, and they believe that climate change will negatively impact their profit. So we would like to show them that that's not the case. So we believe that consumers can change that perspective just by the way that they spend their money. But they need information to be able to do that. So that's where I come in as a carbon analyst. So we analyze, our carbon analytics team analyze what businesses are doing in terms of climate change and climate action. And we convert those very qualitative and vague statements or commitments, as well as their actual like greenhouse gas emission reduction targets, into something that the everyday person can understand. So that is sort of the where the carbon analytics comes in. It's understanding climate change, understanding how to tackle it, and using analytics to convert that into something someone can understand.
And so is it, it's kind of more statistical and looking at numbers and figures and information rather than a more kind of scientific thing, is that correct?
That's vaguely correct. At Zero Carbon, we've developed our own carbon rating methodology, and so that's the methodology that distills a company's climate performance into a rating. So our ratings range from AAA to E. And to do that, that's a range of statistics and non-statistical methods.
We'll dive into that in more in a minute. But So where do you get your information from? Is it because
for the companies,
for the carbon information for the companies? Where does that information come from?
Yeah, so again, we believe transparency is fundamental in a climate-friendly world. So we're looking for companies to disclose their information on what they're doing. So that's in their lovely, very long and very readable annual statements, sustainability reports, their websites, press releases.
You're taking the publicly available information that the companies produce and put out into the world, and you're then analysing that and saying, well, given that information, this is what we think that means.
Yep. So we're scraping the various statements and commitments they make and pulling out the stuff that's relevant to climate.
And what do you do about those statements which you may or may not believe?
That's a great question. And that is unfortunately what we see a lot in this space, isn't it? A lot of greenwashing and a lot of statements that feel a bit empty promises, and no one likes those. So part of our process is we do engage with the companies we're rating, and we do get a relatively good engagement rating, but unfortunately not all of them do. So as part of that process, we'll clear up any vagueness or information that we want some more detail on, but definitely a lot of cross-checking. But mainly our algorithm is fairly robust, and so we're not looking for just a tick and flick. We are looking for depth, and so you might get a few points for just having a statement, say the hot topic of we've got a net zero target, or we're committed to net zero. You would only get a tiny weeny portion of our points in our rating system. You need to have a real transition pathway to get the full scope of points.
And do you take any notice of history? Just something we've noticed is that, you know, company will say something 2 years ago, a statement about their climate change or sustainability efforts, and then 2 years later it'll be a different statement having not met the previous statement. Do you do any kind of historical
view? I'll answer that in two ways, because history is interesting in my perspective, from two sides of the coin, which is definitely like carbon emissions performance. So we are evolving our algorithm to not only look at moving forward targets, but to actually look at actual performance as well and rate that. So our algorithm will update over time. So if you don't hit a target or exceed a target, on the flip side, if we're going to be positive, some companies might say they want to reduce their emissions by 10% and actually do 15, which is great. So we will rate and encourage performance against targets, as well as a really interesting historical component to our ratings is the use of influence.
Okay.
So a lot of companies will either be using their influence for good or for bad. And that can contradict a lot of what they're saying on the surface. So a company might be saying they support a good controversial one is emission reduction targets or cap and trade schemes. But then under the hood, they're actually participating in negative lobbying to undermine those efforts. So we do a very comprehensive influence analysis as part of the rating.
We have stories on the show, and I think I remember one we had Apple that was saying, you know, we're reducing carbon in all these sorts of areas. And then the next week there was a story about, you know, worker rights abuses in, you know, some of their factories. And you think, well, this is the same company. How can they be doing the same things? Bringing it back a step, you mentioned at the start about giving a voice to consumers. Tell us more about that. How does that concept work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And that concept works, I guess, the average consumer doesn't know, a great example, they don't know what scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions are. They don't know under the hood how emission reductions schemes work. So our understanding is that consumers really want to do good on climate. They want to shop sustainably. They just don't have any information as to how to do that.
Sure.
So that is the whole reason for us developing a carbon rating algorithm is to be able to take the elements of good climate action and convert that into something that we're used to seeing. AAA to E score, we're very used to getting scored at school. You know, you don't want to get the C plus, you want to get the A. So the idea behind empowering consumers is you've got to give them a tool to be empowered to make those informed decisions. So we're actively working on ways to give them our carbon ratings easier. So at the moment they're on our website and our social media, but we're currently developing a mobile application, and that will be rolled out in mid-February. And that would give you the ability to just open your mobile and search for a brand, and it will give you their rating as well as all the related companies.
So are you aware of, is it Ethical Consumer Magazine?
I haven't heard of Ethical Consumer Magazine.
Well, I'll send you a link, and I'll
tell
put
me
a link,
about them.
I'll put a link on the show page for listeners to have a look at. They do a kind of a sustainability rating. It's not carbon purely, but it's across a broad range of different topics. And they've got thousands of companies that they've rated as part of the work that they do. But they do something similar. It's not a mobile app, I don't think. It's just a website. But you can go and look at any number of companies and say, you know, are there any issues here with what they're doing and the way they're performing? So it's something similar, but it suffers from the problem that you've just outlined, which is I'm in the supermarket, I'm in the shop, and I want to make a buying decision now, but I don't have the information to make that decision. And, you know, if all these consumers can make those decisions on the spot, then companies are going to change what they do. I guess that's that collective power. But labeling, carbon labeling, and I guess your AAA down to E kind of plays into this. How do you see that working out? Because wouldn't it be lovely if we had, much like we do with food, we have like fats and sugars and kind of traffic light systems on the packages and things like that. Do you see something like that in the future for carbon, or
Yes, 100%. Again, being very positive, I think carbon labelling is fundamental to us moving forward. And that is actually an element we do assess in our rating system. So we do look for any companies that are already doing or have committed to doing some form of carbon labelling for their products moving forward. It's definitely something we hear when talking to the companies that engage with us. That's a big challenge for them a lot because of the lack of methodology or even the hesitation to do it because if their competitor started doing it and used a different methodology, they might not have comparable results and therefore be negatively disadvantaged. But I think we have to encourage it and the consumers have to demand it for it to really start becoming mandatory.
Yeah, and across international borders, I guess, is a challenge as well because you know, we have different food standards, for example, in the UK to, I guess, what you have in Australia, and they're certainly different to what are in the US. And so having a labelling standard that meets different underlying standards is a challenge, isn't it? Wouldn't it be nice to have one worldwide carbon label?
I think we can get there. If you look at, I don't know if you guys have it in the UK, but if you look at, we have the Healthy Heart stars on a lot of products in the grocery stores here in Australia. And that was something that I think if you'd asked people years ago that never would have been uptake because who would want like a packet of Tim Tams, which is an Aussie icon biscuit, has a health rating of 0.5, which is terrible, but people still buy it and at least it's transparent that it's terrible for you. Yeah. So I think we've overcome those hurdles of big corporations saying consumers don't need to know this in the past. And I think carbon's the next thing they want to know.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the UK, they've legislated for it. So it's the law that you have to have these labels on the packaging. And that's why when something, and I don't know whether it's Oreos or Tim Tams or McVitie's Digestives on that packet of biscuits.
Oh, they're good. I do love those biscuits.
I do want a biscuit. I want a biscuit now. on those packet of biscuits in the UK, we have a traffic light thing. So they would have a big red square that says, this is really sugary and this is really fatty. But it's a different label to what you've got in Australia and again, different to the US. And I think that's a challenge, isn't it? You know, having those different things. So you mentioned that you've engaged with some companies about carbon labelling. And we mentioned earlier on that you get information from annual reports about companies' carbon. Are there any issues with companies actually knowing what carbon they use? Do you see that? Because
we do see that, but to a lesser degree, I think, than a few years ago. The demand for climate action, or at least carbon transparency, has really transformed sustainability reports across the globe in the last couple of years. So if you're talking the big corporations, most of them are doing greenhouse gas accounting, that is using an approved method. They're getting it verified through consultants. So you do see a lot of big companies doing it well. We do talk to quite a few of the small startup sustainable companies, and they are struggling with it because obviously it's a large commitment. It's quite comprehensive, and for smaller organizations that's where the struggle is. So would definitely love to see some help thrown their way with some tools to make their life easier.
And I think what we see is that, you know, 97% of businesses are small businesses. They're not these huge multinationals or huge national corporations that have the capacity and resource to know these things. They are kind of tiny businesses. And I think whether you're a tiny business or you're a huge one, always look at it with some skepticism when I see their carbon report, because what is the scope of that? Do you know the scope of activity? That is, because
you stole my segue right out of my mouth.
I'll let you carry on. What is the scope of what you look at?
So that's exactly one of the hottest topics now. So we've seen the uptake of disclosure across companies, but now we're seeing like the critical eye to what that disclosure actually includes. So here as a carbon analyst at Zero Carbon, we're looking for full, what we call value chain emissions. So that's really a footprint of their entire activity. So that's what we call scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3. To give a good example, there's some Australian banks that say that they are carbon neutral across their entire emissions. And when you look at that, they do disclose their scope one and their scope two and their scope three emissions. But if you dive under the hood and look at what they're including in their scope three, which is what we call their indirect impact, all they're including is like commuting and corporate travel on aeroplanes to get from Sydney to Melbourne. And what that really misses is, if we're looking at the value of a bank, is their lending activity and their asset portfolio. So who they're lending money to and what that then does downstream. So a bank is not just the lights in the offices and the lights in the branches and the energy used to power their ATMs. It is also what is the consequence of who they're lending to. And often they're lending to fossil fuel companies. So we look at comprehensive everything. We want a company to be taking accountability for all of their emissions, even if that does result in the age-old debate about double counting when you look at it globally.
And I guess that it's such a difficult one, this. And I don't often have some sympathy for large companies, but I kind of do in this space, because, you know, that scope of your emissions and the emissions you have an influence over, you know, you are employing numbers of staff and you are paying them and they are obviously commuting, but, you know, they are eating in your office, or are you providing on-site canteen facilities and they're choosing to eat a burger instead of a salad? And, you know, which of that are you responsible for? And are you responsible for those sorts of things in your supply chain and the things that you buy? So it's, even if you have a full scope of inclusion, it's still, there's still gray areas at the edges, aren't there, around what you kind of include and what you don't. And
there are, and generally, I mean, what you're looking for to reduce those indirect, the stuff that you can't control, is you're looking for like partnerships and your use of influence. So taking some of the big companies that could really shift a large chunk of corporate emissions, like let's take mining companies as a great example. So they are fundamental to our future. We need mines to produce the minerals and ores required to build solar panels and build wind turbines. Yep. Like it's a energy intensive but required action. But then their scope three emissions are really challenging, because once the mineral leaves the mine, anyone could do anything with it. They can burn it, they can heat it, they can smelt it, which is like a huge amount of emissions. But they, because they are so big, they can use their influence and say, we're only going to sell our minerals to these people if you can show us that you're also actively reducing your emissions and you've uptake certain sustainability. So your scope three emissions are really challenging, but really powerful. And for most companies, that's where the large chunk of their emissions, true emissions, actually do lie.
So there's a carbon rating finder app that Zero Carbon 2030 are releasing in February. Might even be out by the time this podcast goes live. So
if it is, find it on the app, your preferred app store, and give it a download. And it's definitely our first run. So if you have any feedback, I hope we can pop in the show notes the link to how to contact us at Zero Carbon, and people can send us their feedback on how it's used.
We'll certainly do that. So the app, is it what is it going to do? Tell us what it's going to do.
So it's aim is to be quite simple initially. And all that is the ability to have in your phone the power to like make a more climate friendly choice. So it will just be search a company or search a brand, and it'll give you the rating that we've done. And then it will also give you their related related companies. So say you're looking up a purchase of peanut butter, you might be able to see brand A has A and brand B is a C plus. So you could purchase brand A because it's more friendly.
So it will give you a product. So if I'm looking at, I'm thinking about biscuits now. We've talked about biscuits. And
yeah, you've got you craving them. Yeah, go for it. Biscuits are delicious.
So if we're talking about biscuits, it will show you a list of different biscuits and their comparative carbon things, and then you can say, oh well, those ones are really bad, but these ones, they're terrible formula, I'll have the terrible ones, and you can make that choice from the app.
It's it's just about empowering you to make choices and to shift your money hopefully to support the good guys.
Oh, that sounds amazing. So we'll link it up, even if it's not out by the time the podcast comes out, we'll certainly share it when it is out, because we'd like to try it, and I'm sure lots of listeners would. One other thing I want to talk to you about, you've got a project, Art for Climate Auction.
We do.
And what's that about?
Yeah, so we are a not-for-profit, and so we rely on funding wherever that comes from to help us continue to rate more companies. So one of the things we're doing to raise some money is running an Art for Climate Auction. So that will be a series of artwork, both from our founders kindly donated a lot of his artwork, and also quite a few artists have kindly donated artwork, and that will be an online auction where you can purchase a piece of art and all the proceeds go to Zero Carbon 2030, and that will allow us to do the next iteration on the app or the next iteration of company sectors to rate.
That sounds great. We'll certainly link that, and just to remind listeners that Zero Carbon 2030 is a not-for-profit, so they do need to find ways to continue to bring money in so they can continue to fund the work that they're doing.
Thank you. And depending on when the podcast comes out, if you're listening in February, the Art for Climate Auction is running between the 5th to the 18th of February. So jump on there if it's still live.
Yeah, great. One thing we ask all our guests, Shana, is to recommend a book or a resource or something to us. Is there a book or a film or a website or something you would say, listeners, go and read this, go and look at this, because this is going to improve your understanding of something. Is there something you'd like to suggest?
Yeah, I am an avid reader, so I could probably talk about this for the same length about climate change.
recommend a few, then. You don't have to just choose one.
I definitely can recommend two, I guess, stereotyping the type of readers type of listeners that would be on this podcast. One of which is a lovely fiction book called The History of Bees, which is by a Norwegian writer. I think it was her debut novel. And it's a great story that follows three generations who are all connected through the tiny insect of the bee, which it's a gorgeous story, but with an underpinning of how nature connects us all, and also the need to act before the climate crisis. I think it was written at the time that the bee extinction was very topical. So it's a great fiction book.
It still is. I mean, it's brilliant. We've had stories on the show in the last couple of weeks about UK introducing pesticides, which are killing bees. That sounds like a lovely recommendation. I think we'll look that one out. And there was another one you said you were going to.
Yeah. So on the flip side of a fiction book that's quite like wholehearted but beautiful, then I've got a non-fiction, which is a book called The Nature Fix. And that's an amazing book. Collaborated with a whole bunch of neuropsychologists, and they look at how and why nature makes us happy.
Right.
And if you've ever wondered what it would be like to go for a hike and see what your brainwaves do during the hike and then after the hike, that is the book for you.
I'm not sure I want to go anywhere inside my own brain, to be honest. I worry about it sometimes.
It's a really interesting book. The age old, why do we keep national parks around? What value do they have? It's really powerful in that realm.
Wow. Shana, those are some really interesting recommendations and completely different to anything else we've had before. So
there you go.
I'm sure our listeners will love those.
I will take that as a compliment. As a positive, that's and not a negative.
Definitely is. That's definitely is a compliment. Shana, we could talk about various carbon and reduction and certainly company approaches to these things for a lot longer. But I think that's given our listeners a flavour of the topic and an introduction to Zero Carbon 2030. So listeners, I would encourage you all, go and check out the rating app. Sounds amazing. And go and check out Zero Carbon 2030. And just want to say, Shana, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope maybe get to talk to you again in the future.
Thanks, Mike. And if I can sign off with one thing, because a true analyst wouldn't leave without some stats. Okay. So I thought I'd just give a bit of an understanding of some of the stats we've gathered at Zero Carbon.
Oh, okay.
So we've rated a bit over 120 companies so far. We've only been going for a few months, so that'll be more. And from that, our average rating is a C minus. And only 44% of the companies we've rated are committed to 100% renewables. And of that, only 22% have full value chain emissions accounted for. And of those, only 16% have carbon neutrality targets for all of their emissions. So our aim and our ethos is to be able to use you guys as consumers to up those numbers by 2030. So we'd love to have the power of your voices behind us to help do that.
Maybe we could revisit this in 12 months time and look at those numbers again and say where have we got to now, and have they?
We all love a good trend, don't we?
Yeah. We do, certainly if it's upwards. Brilliant. Yes. Okay, Shana. thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mike.
Cheers. Right, now a look behind the scenes, and something coming up next month. We're obviously in the middle of our February challenge, but coming up in March, it's B Corp month, a month where, as a B Corp ourselves, we want to kind of celebrate that fact and to talk about being a B Corp and what that means. And through the means of the Green Elephant Show podcast we have, we're going to take B Corp month a stage further, maybe a stage too far, some people might say. we are aiming to have 31 days of, there are 31 days in March, aren't there?
There are 31 days
Good.
In March.
31 days of B Corps. And so we're in the process of lining up a whole series of B Corps with some very well-known B Corp organisations, both here in the UK and around the world. So we've got some really interesting companies, companies that you'll all have heard of, that are trying to do the right thing in the sustainability space. So that's a really exciting thing that's going to be coming up to a headset or a speaker near you in March, or other auditory experiences if you have them.
The downside, of course, is that neither you nor me will speak much, because we're going to throw the floor open to somebody else, which is just wrong.
I know, listeners, don't be too sad. But if you are a B Corp and you're listening to this, we have a few slots remaining, not many, you'll have to be quick. But if you want to get involved, then drop a note to studio@greenelephant.show, and maybe we'll be speaking to you soon. Also this week we had our first Clubhouse Week in Sustainability. Last week, had a few people join us to discuss the week's news. And if anybody would like to join us, we're doing the same again this Friday at, Russell, is it?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock. This Friday at 10 o'clock on Clubhouse, this week in sustainability. Be great to see as many of you there as possible. And interestingly, I was on Clubhouse listening to a discussion yesterday, and they had a woman who was a real expert in ocean plastics, has been educating on ocean plastics for 40 years and presenting TV programs on ocean plastics for that time. So really not just, you know, new knowledge, but in-depth long-term knowledge, and was talking about plastic bags and that sort of thing, and was saying that in order to offset the carbon and, you know, justify the use of a plastic bag, you'd have to use it 10 times to kind of, you know, offset that. But in the case of a cotton bag, which is what we're all being encouraged to do, these kind of reusable, you know, cotton bags that we're meant to use time after time, she says you need to use that bag 100 times to offset the carbon used in producing that. And in her opinion, you know, we're always told that plastic bags are bad, but actually, unless you're going to use that bag 100 times, and it's not going to fall apart before then you're better off going with plastic. And that was, you know, just, I mentioned that because that is some of the really interesting debate and insight that you get on Clubhouse.
That is quite interesting, because two of the people I'll be speaking to in B Corp month have already told, are experts on things like microfibers and microplastics. Mm. And of course you might have a CO2 benefit, but that plastic will eventually end up in a fish and in our plants and in our bellies.
Yeah.
And we have yet to resolve that particular thing. So CO2 is one part of the argument. And this is such a difficult thing, isn't it? It's all balance.
Yeah,
all balance.
It certainly is.
And now it's time for Fact or Fake. And Russell, just remind the listeners before we start, how long did you work in local government for?
30 years.
Okay, so quite a while. So you should be au fait with government policy and government approaches to things.
Well, Mike.
Yes. Well, fact or fake, this week, based on the back of the story of the French government didn't meet its commitments, I thought I'd dive into what the UK government was saying around sustainability and its commitments. So I've pulled a few statements from government documents around what we're doing for sustainability and climate. And Russell, given your expertise, you should find this easy. I'm expecting a 5 out of 5 score from you this week. So, up first, the Sustainable Development Specific Impact Test should be applied when first considering an issue and throughout the policy development process as appropriate.
Is that a
factual statement from the government? I'll read it to you again. The Sustainable Development Specific Impact Test should be applied when first considering an issue and throughout the policy development process as appropriate.
Well, on the basis that we defined SDGs earlier, I'm going to say that's a fact, Mike.
That is a fact. That is from the government guidance on how to develop a sustainable policy.
Uh-huh.
Next. So this is from the school sustainability guidance. We want schools to make their own judgments on how sustainable development should be reflected in their ethos. We want schools to make their own judgments on how sustainable development should be reflected in their ethos. Is that?
It sounds feasible. It wasn't wordy enough. I'm going to say a fake.
No, that was actually a fact. Schools, they effectively, in the school sustainability guidance, they hand off all responsibility to schools and accept none themselves centrally.
Oh,
That was interesting.
Now,
we move on to the Brexit Fisheries Bill, the new Brexit Fisheries Bill.
I'm clued in on this, Mike.
Yeah. The Fisheries Bill gives us the powers to implement our own independent fisheries policies, improve our marine habitats, and ensure the long-term sustainability of the waters around the UK.
Well, I thought that was the intention, so I'm going to have to say that's a fact.
No, that's actually a fake. The Fisheries Bill gives us the power to implement our independent fishery policies, and it wasn't ensure long-term sustainability. It was to guide the long-term sustainability. It wasn't.
Oh.
So the bill, the bill doesn't actually give them any powers to implement sustainability of fisheries. Essentially,
they don't have to ensure it. They just kind of.
Yeah. Ambush. So next is from the sustainability reporting guidance: how to report sustainability. Organisations are required to demonstrate through integrated reporting how sustainability is an essential characteristic within strategic objectives, operations, and policy making.
In which context is this again?
This is a sustainability reporting guidance. I'll read it to you again. Organisations are required to demonstrate through integrated reporting how sustainability is an essential characteristic within strategic objectives, operations, and policy making.
I mean, part of me thinks is that would be the case, but you're so devious, though. You've been fake.
It is a fake because organisations are not required to demonstrate anything. The best the government can do is say you're strongly encouraged to do this. So the guidance on sustainability reporting is not you have to do it. You're strongly encouraged to do it.
That's a shame, really, isn't it? On the basis of our previous
absolutely
things we've had, that needs to change.
And finally, for fact or fake this week, actions UK government departments and their agencies will take to reduce their impacts on the environment are known as the Greening Government Commitments.
That sounds rubbish, doesn't it?
The Greening Government Commitments are the actions the government
takes. Because that sounds pants, you can't possibly have made that up. I'm going to say that's a fact.
Yeah, I was hoping you would think it was so pants that I'd made it up, but no.
Yeah, it wasn't so bad that you would have made it up.
The greening government commitments are the actions the UK government is taking. And yeah, that concludes. Was that a 3-2? He wins again. It's not a 5. I was expecting better. And finally, before we go, normally like to bring you a really good news story. But this week, I want all listeners to go and watch the animation that we've linked in the show page. And it's rare that I've seen a series of dots moving around a screen that have such a profound impact. There's a blue dot representing a whale, and they've tracked a whale, and they've also tracked all the shipping around Northern Ocean. And you can see the whale just getting totally bewildered and lost as it tries to avoid all the ships that are around there, and it's a pretty sobering watch. So
is horrendous. And yeah, it seems to get stuck, and then every now and then it can make its way into a smaller pocket. That's just awful. Yeah.
So one to go and watch. Yeah. Anyway, as always, if you've enjoyed the show, please do go and visit the show page at greenelephant.show. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed and how to find us on all the usual podcast providers. Please do go and visit and review if you can, as it really helps to make the show and keep you entertained. So hopefully see you at greenelephant.show or on social at greenelipod. But until next time, thanks for listening, and we hope you have a sustainable week.